We've had two very serious animal cruelty situations happen in our listening area. In just the last week and a half, we had a situation in Fairfield where both dogs and cats had to be removed from a home. And now this week, hearing in Derby that close to 50 felines had to be removed from a home, some of them already dead inside, others having to be euthanized, and just a slew of issues that the surviving ones are dealing with right now in shelters in our listening area. So we have on the show with us Virginia Maxwell. And Virginia is a professor of forensic science at the University of New Haven. She's here to really look at, well, first of all, she's got a background in kind of looking at these sorts of crimes. She had a 15-year career at the State of Connecticut Forensic Laboratory in Trace Evidence Section. And she currently is the director of a forensic science accredited program and a director for the newly approved animal cruelty investigation graduate certificate. So this is right up her alley in really understanding what's going on and helping us to kind of talk through this and whether we need more oversight for things like in-home rescues. Is that even a possibility? So here's Virginia with us today. Good morning to you, Virginia. Thank you for giving us your time. How are you?
I'm very well. Good morning, Melissa, and thank you very much for having me on.
Yeah. Could you tell me, first of all, what sparked your interest in animal investigations like dog fights or just general animal cruelty in our state?
I've always been an animal lover my whole life, but I think what really sparked it was having had a career in forensic science and not really having any animal cruelty cases coming in. And then the real catalyst for me was about 10 years ago, there was a terrible case up in Massachusetts. It's always referred to as the Puppy Doe case, and it was really one of the worst cases seen. It also was the one that actually got the most prison time for the abuser. But that really was a catalyst for me to kind of switch my focus in terms of the work I was doing outside of the classroom into animal cruelty. And so I've been doing a lot. I've got a textbook coming out next month in it with my co-author, who's a veterinarian. So I've really, kind of devoted a lot of time to this. It's a real passion for me.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk about the two most recent cases I just mentioned at the top of this interview, both Derby and Fairfield. My understanding from both of these, and I have very strong sources for both, saying that these two people who own these properties, who were running these like in-home rescues, if you want to call it that, they didn't mean to cause harm. They certainly didn't. It doesn't sound like they meant to cause harm. They were doing this. They were hoping for the greater good, but it got out of control. How often do we hear that happening for animal cruelty cases?
Hoarding is becoming one of the biggest problems of animal cruelty for what we call companion animals. These are primarily cats and dogs, but they can be other type of animals. But they're generally animals we would look on as our pets. I think really a good place to start with this is understanding what animal hoarding is. And it's a very specific thing. It's actually considered to be a psychological disorder. It's now officially classified as a psychological disorder.
Really?
And it's not just the accumulation of animals. For example, I could have a large number of animals, but as long as I'm taking care of them, I'm providing them with their minimum standards of care, I'm giving them their veterinary care, we've got a nice, clean living environment, they're groomed, they're healthy, they're happy, I'm not a hoarder. So hoarding actually has specific characteristics that go with it. So it's not just the accumulation of animals. It goes with a failure to provide minimal standards of sanitation, of space, of nutrition, of veterinary care. It's then obsessive attempts to accumulate more animals and to maintain the large numbers of animals, even as the conditions are deteriorating. We then add into this an inability to recognize what all of this is doing to the welfare of the animals and, in many cases, human members of the household and the environment. And then also just a denial, to be in a state of denial as to what is going on and what the problem is and what the conditions are for people and animals in that environment. So it goes beyond just having a lot of animals. It's also a failure to care and a failure to recognize what is going on.
So how do you get to that level of hoarding? Because is it that people walk into it already having this, you know, like a mental health crisis, and then they don't recognize that it's becoming like, I had two dogs, now I have 20? How do you get to that level of hoarding?
Well, you know, another thing that we need to understand, or you know, that it's worth knowing about hoarding, is it's not a one-size-fits-all problem. There are three recognized major categories of hoarders. The first category we call an overwhelmed caregiver. And these are people that start out, you know, looking after their animals. Their animals are great. They don't even have a large number. And they usually go through some major life event, like the loss of a family member, you know, a divorce, loss of a job, things like that. And that triggers. And then they start to accumulate animals, and then they get overwhelmed. They may not have the financial resources to care for them. This particular class of hoarder kind of knows that they're overwhelmed, and they're relatively easy to deal with for the authorities. At the other extreme are the exploiter hoarders, and they are very difficult. They are really using the animals as a means to an end. Often they're sociopathic and have personality disorders. They lack empathy. Sometimes they're just looking to gain money through the animals, and they're very difficult to deal with. In the middle, and it sounds like what you're talking about, is a group called the rescue hoarders. And the rescue hoarders have a very strong sense of mission to save animals.
Right.
And this ends up leading to this unavoidable compulsion. They fear death of their animals. And they also feel that they're the only people that can care and save the animals.
Do we in Connecticut have a lack of oversight for in-home rescues? Or better question, is it possible to put in place more oversight for these issues?
You know, that's an interesting question and kind of a complicated one, because these kind of in-home rescues can often start off as a bona fide, a perfectly good, clean organization, and then spiral a little bit out of control. Should there be oversight? It would be, I think, some sort of licensing or registration would definitely be a good start that brought with it some level of inspections off the property. But, you know, it's a difficult thing to have oversight, because one of the characteristics of hoarding is it can be very, very secretive. And so you can have a situation develop without really knowing what is going on behind closed doors, if you see what I mean.
Well, I mean, and that's the other thing. I get questions all the time from people when we do these stories. How do they even get all these animals? Because veterinarians do, and I think so do shelters, they will ask, you know, do you have current animals? And they will ask for references sometimes. But are these animals, the animals that they're getting, are they finding them off the streets? Are they getting them online? Like, how are they even accessing all of these animals?
Well, you know, the rescue hoarder may often have a network of enablers who are getting animals for them. So that's certainly one way. Unfortunately, Craigslist is a source, because, and I wish people wouldn't do it, and I hope people will stop doing it, when people advertise free to a good home, is, you know, a bad thing for the animal. It can end up in a hoarding situation. It can end up in an animal fighting situation. There are plenty of strays out there. You know, people are abandoning animals, unfortunately. So there are ways that they can get the animals. And then plus, if you have a large number of animals that are not spayed or neutered, then the problem is multiplying, you know, right in front of you.
I'm curious, too. We're talking to Virginia Maxwell about animal cruelty cases. You know, while we are dealing with a mental health crisis in the U.S., especially in the last few years, are you concerned, Virginia, that we're going to see more of these situations pop up, or that they are currently happening as we speak and we just don't know about it?
I think it's both. We do know that we have a mental health crisis in the United States that is escalating. We know that the number of hoarding cases are escalating. It's actually Germany that I've found the most recent statistics, and they're showing a huge increase just in the last few years. We believe that in America, well over 250,000 animals are known to get caught up in hoarding situations every year. But of course, those are the ones that we know about. Those are the ones where somebody has gone in and intervened. But, you know, these are often people who are isolated. They say around 50% of all hoarders actually live alone. And if you're in a rural area, you're down, you know, a long driveway in the woods, who's really going to know? And, you know, also in terms of the animals, a lot of these animals are kept indoors. So they're behind closed doors. And so if you're not having people coming to see you, if people aren't getting into your house, no one's really going to know what's going on. So, yes, I do believe we're going to see, and we already are seeing, increases in the number of hoarding cases. And I think, as you said, we have a mental health crisis, and it's worth considering that animal hoarding is actually a symptom of a mental or a psychological disorder. It isn't necessarily the problem itself, if you see what I mean in terms of the difference, that, you know, this should be a clue to us. If we know that somebody is accumulating a lot of animals, that they need help.
And I was just going to say, so you hit the nail on the head there, Virginia, which is that if these things are going on now, or that they're going to continue to increase, we're going to see more of these cases. What I found so irritating, but I understand we also are living in a time where people are nervous to report things. They don't want to get pulled into situations. They don't want to falsely accuse people. But like with this Derby situation, our partners at News 8 had a story, and they talked to neighbors in the area. One who said, oh, yeah, we saw, you know, cats fighting outside the home. Another who's like, yeah, when I'd walk by at night, I could smell urination from the outside of the building. Another who's like, oh, I was approached about, like, do you want a cat? And I thought, well, this cat doesn't even look healthy. These are all accounts. And finally, one neighbor was like, hey, you got to go check this house out. And there were already cats dead inside. There were other cats that were so sick that they needed to be euthanized. But there were so many accounts in that neighborhood, and no one said anything until the camera started rolling and until somebody was arrested. Do you know what I'm saying? So I guess what I'm asking you is, you know, how important is it that people are community policing this sort of thing, even if maybe they're wrong? I don't want to say that they're wrong, because I know that can open Pandora's box, but I think you know what I'm getting at.
Yeah, no, I think it's very, very important that people speak up at an early stage, when they start to, you know, when you see evidence, some of the things that you just said, the odor of urine, ill and emaciated animals, you know, a house that is literally starting to fall apart. You know, someone could talk to the local animal control officer, the local law enforcement officer, and ask them, you know, to just check on this. And, you know, one thing that I'll add that maybe would be an incentive is, you know, hoarding cases are massively expensive for the town in which they're occurring, because all of those 200, you know, 100, 200 animals that are pulled out of a hoarding situation have to be cared for, because they're evidence in a criminal case. So it's the town that usually ends up having to pay for all of the shelter and the veterinary care of these animals. So nipping a hoarding case in the bud, you know, is financially beneficial for a town. But it is a community problem, because hoarding brings with it disease, you know, squalor, deterioration of a house. So people really should speak up if they feel, because it's also for the benefit of the individual. There is a bill that is in the legislature right now that actually is going to, if passed, would bring in mandatory veterinary reporting of things like neglect or suspected cruelty. If a hoarder is bringing an animal to the veterinarian would be required to report things like that. But it also brings with it a Good Samaritan cover for the veterinarian as well, that, you know, they, if they're mandated to report, they would also be exempt from civil liability. So, you know, that will be an important step as well, is to have the ability for veterinarians to report.
Well, Virginia Maxwell, I really appreciate having you come on to talk about this and the seriousness of these cases. And I'm sure I'll have you back on the show very soon. I wish that wasn't the case for what we're talking about, but I have a feeling you're going to be on the show pretty often. So thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Melissa. I appreciate the time.
Absolutely. Virginia Maxwell here on WICC. According to national reports, peanut allergies are the second most common food allergies in children, and it's on the rise, actually. It occurs in about 1 in 50 children and 1 in 200 adults. So it's something that is really impacting so many people. So when we heard news earlier this month about a skin patch showing great promise, especially in toddlers with peanut allergies, I had to talk to someone about it. So welcoming back to the show today, Dr. Philip Hemmers, who's an allergist with the Hartford Healthcare St. Vincent's Medical Center. So glad to talk about this topic with you, Dr. Hemmers. How are you?
I'm great. Thank you for having me.
So tell us, Dr. Hemmers, what is your understanding of this patch? Can you talk a little bit about it?
Yes, it's very exciting. The patch has been in development for several years, and this recent study tested the patch for kids as young as 1 year of age. It tested kids from 1 to 3, and it was very effective. Children going into the study had very high, severe peanut allergies, and they would wear the patch with a little bit of peanut on their skin. They did this daily for 1 year, and at the end of the study, their peanut allergy was significantly less. They were able to tolerate higher amounts of peanut. They had less severe reactions, and it really provided significant peace of mind for both the children and parents.
So how young can children use this patch? What's the youngest age?
So the exciting part is that there's all types of treatment options that are now available. 5 years ago, we didn't have anything. We would instruct parents to avoid peanut and teach them how to read labels, make sure they were prepared for severe allergic reactions, make sure they carried life-saving devices with them. Currently today, there's a commercially available product for kids ages 4 and up, but there's a real window of opportunity to start treating kids younger, as young as 1 year of age. The immune system is more adaptable at that age, and we think there's a greater chance to do good and hopefully cure more kids of peanut allergy.
So let's talk a little bit about that, Dr. Hemmers. So you're talking a very, very young age being exposed to this patch. And I know just from experience, my nephew is severely allergic to a few different items, peanuts being one of them. Is this something that obviously you'd have to talk to your pediatrician about, but is it something that could at least lower how significant their reaction is, or could it completely eliminate their peanut allergy altogether?
Great. That's a great question. And the primary goal of the treatment is to protect kids from allergic reaction, to improve the quality of life and improve socialization. It'd be great if we can cure the peanut allergy, but that's not the primary goal. That's not what we've proven to be effective at this point. It's that kids on treatment, whether it's treatment through the skin with a patch or something called oral immunotherapy, where children are ingesting very small doses of peanut. The goal of the treatment is to provide protection, and we're getting much better at that.
And we're talking to Dr. Philip Hemmers, who's an allergist and immunologist with Hartford Healthcare St. Vincent's Medical Center, really about this patch, a skin patch to treat peanut allergies. But also, I want to talk about peanut allergies more generally, if you don't mind, Dr. Hemmers. Why are we seeing more and more cases of people having this allergic reaction, having a sensitivity to peanuts? Why are we seeing that?
That's another good question, because peanut allergy has been on the rise for 20 years now. The overwhelming reason, it's called the hygiene hypothesis. And our immune system has to decide at a very young age what is good and bad, what is harmful or not. And developing an allergy to food is really the wrong direction. Food proteins are harmless. But because our immune systems are not trained correctly, we have vaccines, we have clean running water. Our immune systems don't learn right from wrong at that young age. And there's also some other factors in the way foods are made and processed. There are topical products that contain peanut protein. You add all these things together, and that leads to the dramatic rise in peanut allergy.
So in layman's terms, only because I want to make sure I break this down correctly and that I'm understanding you,
sure.
It comes down to our immune system and how well they can fight things off or adapt, rather, to certain products.
100% an allergy to peanut or any other product, food or pollen, that's an overreaction of the immune system. It's an inappropriate response. Our immune system should be protecting us from viruses and bacteria. it should not be fighting peanut proteins or dog dander.
So that kind of leads me to this question. Do you think we're going to see an even bigger spike because of the pandemic and how much that's messed with our immune systems? I mean, even just this allergy season, I've had two cancellations this week alone because people now have laryngitis, their allergies are acting up. We've got shortages at people's workplaces because all of a sudden the allergy season is just horrible, you know, in the last few years, but especially this year, the pollen count is awful and the exposure. I mean, and a lot of people look to the pandemic and how we sort of like put a pause on our immune systems for a little bit.
Yeah, the last few years, patient-reported pollen allergy has been lower. People have been spending more time indoors and outdoors wearing masks, and that helps to filter the pollen. Do you combine that with the very warm winter we had and global changes in climate, and you have much higher pollen levels this year? So it's really bad. As far as the peanut and the other foods, we're trying interventions to prevent any further rise, and we've been successful at leveling off those numbers. Things like early food introduction have been helpful in lowering the amount of peanut allergy we see.
So I was looking up just to get an idea of how many things are impacted by peanuts. And we always think about all the foods that contain peanuts, for example. But then there are the non-food sources, like there are, you know, different feeds. There is stuffing and toys that have peanut oil, sunscreens, vitamins, skin creams, cosmetics, lip glosses, even arts and craft materials, just to name a few different things. So we understand why this impacts so many people, especially if they have a peanut allergy. And we're talking to Dr. Hemmers about this because there's a skin patch that is showing a lot of promise in helping kids deal with their peanut allergies in a better way. At what point, Dr. Hemmers, would you say that adults should start introducing peanut products to children, either to lower their chances of having a peanut allergy or to better expose them so they don't have such a bad reaction?
Good question. That's of course, I'm going to say that individual parents need to discuss that with their pediatrician. In general, we're definitely starting kids at an earlier age, trying to get peanut introduced, get kids used to it, get their immune systems used to it in order to prevent allergy. And right now, for a child without risk of peanut allergy, without eczema or a close relative with peanut allergy, we encourage parents to start as young as 6 months. They can introduce a peanut powder or peanut butter into a cereal. They can dilute it that way. And there, for kids who are able, there are peanut puffs. So we like early, even in kids at higher risk, in consultation with their pediatrician and allergist, we try to start kids before 1 year of age. There's a real window of opportunity there where you can teach their body, can get their immune system used to peanut. It's 110% better to prevent the allergy than develop it.
Now, you said something interesting there, Dr. Hemmers, which I had not heard before. Is there a tie between eczema and peanut allergies?
Yes. Up to 30 to 40% of kids with eczema will have a peanut allergy. And the more severe the eczema, the more likely there is a peanut allergy. And it's a really interesting connection because some of the genetic mutations or reasons why you can have eczema are those same genetic mutations that increase the risk for peanut allergy. Even putting a topical product, a cream or a lotion that has peanut protein on broken down, eczematous, itchy skin will significantly increase the chance of developing a peanut allergy.
No kidding. So I have eczema. I've had it my whole life. And once you get to that age 25 and they're like, yep, you ain't outgrowing it. Here I am.
Sorry.
No, it's fine. No. This is why I think it's really interesting. So I had used, I'm not going to use the line, but I had tried just like a, you know, something for sensitive skin, like a face wash or whatever. And this was a few years back. It was my first year on WICC and I broke out in dermatitis all over my face. And I had to leave the station. We were doing a radiothon. I'll never forget this. I literally had to leave because I was such a disaster. And they're like, what in the world did you put in your face? And I'm like, these guys. And they're like, that's weird because they've got a real, like a really great, reputable skincare line. Great for sensitive, great for eczema, yada, yada, yada. I've never heard that there is a connection between eczema and peanut allergies. I wonder if there's peanut oil in there. Like I only use, you know, the stuff that my dermatologist gives me, essentially. But I've never heard that, Ty. And my son has eczema, very, very light eczema, but he doesn't have any sensitivity to peanuts, which actually leads me to my next question. Can you outgrow a peanut allergy or get diagnosed with a peanut allergy later on in life? So go through childhood with no problem with peanuts and then all of a sudden develop it in your teens or even young adult years?
First of all, as you pointed out, eczema can be quite debilitating. And it's not just peanut allergy that you're at increased risk for, because your skin barrier is not as strong when you have eczema. When it's broken down, you're at risk to develop allergies to lots of things, especially chemicals and moisturizers and other skin products.
Awful. Yes,
even,
that's me.
Even the steroids you use to treat the rash, you can develop allergy to.
Yep, it's great. You are speaking my language.
Great.
It's great. I love it. Yes. That's why they call it a skin disease, though. I say that all the time. I'm always like, yes, eczema is a skin disease. And it can be very debilitating. There have been times in my life where I'm like in pain constantly because of it. And you just can't use certain things. It's crazy. But go on, Dr. Hemmers. I just appreciate when people understand.
The effect on quality of life of eczema, I'm just going to reiterate that it's severe. It's comparable to other chronic conditions like diabetes. The way it interferes with your daily life, and especially in kids, the way it interferes with sleep because it's such an itchy condition.
Yeah, it's the worst. It's awful. So you're just speaking my language. So this is something, though, that if, like, for example, so I grew up, I've eaten PB&Js forever. I have no problem with them. Is that something I could develop, though, later in life, a peanut allergy? Or, like, could my son, who loves PB&Js, at some point having eczema, could he develop a peanut allergy?
So it's possible. Most peanut allergy we see at a young age. We see in infants and toddlers. And the best thing that you and your son can do is continue to eat those PB&Js. The more you're exposed, your body's going to stay used to it. It's really unlikely you're going to develop a peanut allergy at this point. It's not impossible. It does happen. But continuing to eat that, you know, those Reese's peanut butter cups will keep you healthy in some way.
Okay, so I just want to make sure that Derek, if my husband's listening right now, you heard the good doctor correctly. I need to keep eating Reese's peanut butter cups in order to stay alive. That's what I mostly heard, right? I mean, I may have like changed your words a little bit.
I can write you a prescription for that, for sure.
Can you? Oh, that would be so wonderful, actually. Yes, if I need to have, what, 1, 2, 5, how many Reese's peanut butter cups should I be having a day, do you think? To make sure
minimum
I'm, you know.
Minimum 1 dozen.
Okay. All right. Yes, if you could write me that prescription, Dr. Hemmers, that would be excellent. I have no problem with that. Yes, that would be great. That sounds delicious. Well, Dr. Hemmers, I learned an awful lot today. I like so much. I thank you so much for coming on the show and sharing all of this with us.
No problem. It's my pleasure. Thank you.
Always a pleasure to talk to Dr. Hemmers. And again, if people do want to learn more, of course, you can always go to hartfordhealthcare.org. Dr. Philip Hemmers, who is an allergist and immunologist with Hartford Healthcare's St. Vincent's Medical Center here on WICC. I am honored to welcome to the show today Del Monte Jefferson, who is the executive director of the Center for Black Health and Equity. And we are talking about menthol cigarettes, the FDA to hopefully ban menthol cigarettes in flavored cigars because of how much it impacts people's health in a very negative way. Del Monte, welcome to the show. Glad to have you here.
Hey, thanks for having me, Melissa. I'm glad to be here this morning.
Yeah, it was actually 1 year ago this month that the FDA issued proposed rules to ban menthol cigarettes in flavored cigars. For people who don't understand why there's such a push for this nationwide, could you talk about that really quickly, Del Monte?
Well, yeah, menthol cigarettes have been targeted to Black communities and other people of color and to our youth and LGBT populations for decades. And it's targeted to our populations because it's got this minty flavor that makes smoking tobacco a lot easier and makes it easier for you to start smoking and harder for you to stop smoking. So we've got a social justice issue that we're trying to deal with here, that targeting, disproportionate targeting of this product to our populations.
Forgive me for asking this question, Del Monte, but why specifically does it impact, like you were saying, like Black populations? You know, when you say, so I don't smoke anything, so I have no concept or understanding of this. But when you say minty flavor, like to me, that sounds like any flavored tobacco product, which is an issue for any any population, especially the younger. Like, I agree with the younger. I just was curious why we've seen over generations that menthol cigarettes are specifically targeting that population.
Well, the tobacco industry is out for profits. In their own words, they don't smoke tobacco. They reserve that right to the young, the poor, the stupid, and the black. Now, this is what they say in their documents. So that's who they're targeting tobacco products for, young, poor, stupid, and black. So that would be kids, low SES, of course, African-Americans. That's who they're targeting these products for. Now, if you go to our communities, if you go to black communities, well, listen, you ride by a storefront, you're going to see these large ads for Newport or Kool or whatever, large ads. But you go to white communities, you're not going to see those same type of large ads.
I see.
If you go to a black store, I don't know if you know this, but menthol cigarettes are 50 cents cheaper than they would be in a corresponding white store. And so this is targeting. This is saying, I want this group to smoke this product. Let me tell you what happened as a result of it.
Mm-hmm.
85% of black Americans that smoke menthol products. Targeted marketing works. And so that's what they did. And that was the result that they got. And that was the result that they wanted.
That's ridiculous. I mean, clearly lot of data backing that up. That's awful. That's horrible. Oh, my gosh.
That's awful. Now, what's even more awful, because you talked earlier about the FDA and coming out with the proposed rule, what's even more awful was that in 2009, when the FDA was saying, well, wait a minute, we're going to ban flavors. We're going to ban strawberry. We're going to ban grape and watermelon. We don't need those flavors in our cigarettes because those are attacking kids. Well, they exempted menthol, the main flavor, and the main flavor that African-Americans and blacks use. And so it was amazing. That's the amazing part, that you would exempt the number one flavor, but you would ban all of these other flavors. And so that's the amazing thing. And that's what we've been fighting for since 2009.
And I'd imagine, again, I'm not putting words in anybody's mouth, but does it come down to the God Almighty buck? I mean, why would you not shut down that industry if it's killing people?
That's a great thing, the God Almighty buck. And it's, unfortunately, it's not just one buck. You're talking about billions and billions of bucks is what we're talking about. And so menthol, that menthol flavor that makes this poison go down easier. And by the way, you know, the menthol is put there so that you can smoke it. You can try it originally. But the real harm, of course, is the nicotine, which gets you addicted to the product. And then once you're addicted, you know, you can't get off. And so menthol is there to lure you in, and once you're lured in, you're hooked. Well, that menthol flavor is in every single tobacco product. It's not just in the ones that have the characterizing flavor of menthol, like Newports or Kools. It's not just there. It's in Marlboro. It's in everything that's out there. It's in Snuff. You know, it's in the Chew. It's in everything. Not at the same amounts, not at the same levels, but there is menthol in every single tobacco product.
So DeMonte Jefferson is here, the executive director at the Center for Black Health and Equity. He's responsible for the strategic direction and oversight of the organization. And I'm curious, DeMonte, do you have any statistics about how many people, their health, I want to say health statistics, how many people have died because of their use of menthol cigarettes?
Well, 45,000 African Americans, and that's 45,000 African Americans die each year from a tobacco-related disease. And so, and again, if 85% of African Americans are smoking mentholated tobacco products, then you can see that a large number of these deaths are due to mentholated tobacco products. Mm-hmm. And so that's what we're trying to fight, and that's how come we started No Menthol Sunday.
Let's talk about No Menthol Sunday, which is coming up this weekend. What is that all about?
Well, yeah, it's a National Observance Day that's led by the Center for Black Health and Equity. And we engage faith organizations and faith congregants to engage their leaders and their communities in discussions about how do you improve your health outcomes. And in particular, how do you get to abstain from using these mentholated tobacco products? And so that's how come we designed this day. And it was designed by faith leaders, actually. We had a faith conference and we had pastors there. We said, well, what can we do? And what they said is, we can all talk from the pulpit on the same day and encourage our congregations to abstain from using tobacco products. And so that was the first no menthol sundae, and that happened over 9 years ago. So this is the ninth one that we're doing this year, the ninth no menthol sundae, and we've got participation from states across the country and even some communities internationally that participate in no menthol sundae. So we want to raise the awareness. We want to encourage people in congregations to quit and abstain from tobacco use, but we also want to involve those members and faith congregations in our efforts to ban the sale of mentholated tobacco products.
Is the FDA expected to make, you know, a final decision on whether or not to ban it, you know, anytime soon?
Is the FDA expected to make a decision? Yes, they were supposed to actually come back in April 28th of this year and to tell us how they were going to implement that final rule. That has not happened yet. And so we've been trying to get the FDA to do something since they made that mistake back in 2009. They have been slow to act. 2013, we filed a citizen petition to say, well, wait a minute, you've got all the data you need, you've got all the resources you need, make a decision. They didn't act. So in 2020, we sued the FDA. And so the FDA was sued. And so they had to make a decision by the April 21st of 2021. And that's when they said, well, wait a minute, we're going to develop a proposed rule, give us a year to do it. And so we gave them the year. And so on April 28th in 2022, they announced the rule. And so in 2023 is when they were supposed to tell us how they were going to implement, and we're still waiting. So this is going to be a long, long process, Melissa. We're not holding up, crossing our fingers and saying this is going to happen anytime soon, because even after they announced the rule, the tobacco industry is then going to sue and they're going to litigate. And that can take 5-10 years. Who knows how long that's going to go on. And so we are advocating at the local level and at the state level to ban the sale of mentholated tobacco products. We've had success there, and we want to continue having success there and not wait on the FDA. We cannot wait on the FDA. We have no idea when that's going to happen.
And it's also so important to get the awareness out there to help people to understand it better and to have those conversations, especially with young people, about the dangers of these products and to stay away from them as much as possible. So, Del Monte, I appreciate the work that you do and so many others advocating for this major change. And good luck, especially with this upcoming Sunday. Good luck to all of you. And I hope to continue talking to you about this. You know, this issue, whenever you want. I think it's so important that we continue to get the word out there.
Thank you so much for having me, and we'll be in touch.
I look forward to it. Del Monte Jefferson here on WICC.